Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. Thank you everybody for coming today. So good morning and welcome to the 37th annual Helen Hamilton Day celebration. My name is Stephanie Arneal and I have served as the Helen Hamilton Day coordinator for the Law Women's Caucus over the past year to plan today's events. I've had the honor of working with the board at the University of Law School to celebrate Helen Hamilton, who was the first female graduate. A brief history of Helen Hamilton. She was the first female graduate of the University of North Dakota School of Law in 1905, and at that time, states did not allow women to get called to the bar. And it was not until 1920, 15 years after Helen Hamilton's graduation from law school, that the states began admitting women. So in 1925, she became a member of the American Bar Association and practiced in Grand Forks for 43 years. At a local law firm until she passed away in 1949 at the age of 75. And since then, women have made up about half of the graduating classes coming out of University of North Dakota. So the theme for this year for Helen Hamilton Day is ordinary women doing extraordinary things, even though they are all extraordinary. And as a board, we decided on this theme because we wanted to recognize the strong female presence within our community and what these women have been able to accomplish and overcome over their lifetime and their careers. So we're thrilled to welcome a fantastic lineup of panelists and to speak on this theme, beginning with our panel today, which is the Advocate for Women's Rights panel. This includes Ms. Maria Matusis, the attorney from Peterson King in Winnipeg. You want to give them a wave? And then we have Jennifer Cook, professor at the UND School of Law, and Misty Heelman, and she's the executive director of BioGirls. I would like to take this opportunity to thank everybody for joining us today, and the Law Women's Caucus appreciates your support, and I hope you enjoy today's events. I'm going to hand it over to our moderator, our president of Law Women's Caucus, Victoria Taylor.
Thank you, Stephanie, and thank you for all your hard work on this event. We're going to start this panel off. I'm going to invite each of you to give a little background about yourself and present your bio before we head into the questions. So, Ms. Matusis, we'll start with you.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank everyone for the invitation. Tammy, it's been a great event. It's so lovely to meet with everyone. Some stories. So my name is Maria Matusis. I am a lawyer from Winnipeg, Manitoba. As of today, big announcement, I'm the new owner of my own law firm. So that's very exciting. I'd say I've got two. Thank you. And I do have to leave you early because I have to go back and literally sign papers. So I've been a family lawyer. I got my call to the bar in 2005, articled with Legal Aid Manitoba and the family law department there. Came to law very, as I said, circuitously. Didn't want to be a lawyer, didn't know anything about law. Had my background in Greek and Latin and art history, and just ended up in law school doing family law. But I've been in private practice after my articles and was drawn to the area of family law practice. I'm a very ordinary person, I have to say that first of all, but I had something very extraordinary happen to me in 2015. I was injured when I was the target of a bomb that was mailed to my office by the ex-husband of one of my clients, and I was seriously injured and took me out of the practice for about a year and a half. I lost my hand, but didn't lose my resolve to come back to law. So I am, I think, going to hopefully provide a little bit of a perspective for you all about facing some adversity in practice. One thing I've spoken about before is that you don't need to have something very extraordinary happen to you, like what happened to me, to anticipate that there are going to be times in your practice and times in your life where you're going to have to face challenges, adversity, things outside of your control. And how do you keep true to what you want to do, what you want to do in your practice, what you want to achieve in your life, knowing that you don't have all the answers all the time, you don't have the control, and you don't have certainly the ability to avoid everything that might come your way. So I'm thrilled to be here and to hopefully share some insights about that.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming. It's great to see so many lovely faces in the crowd, and thank you to the LWC for putting on this event every single year to honor Helen Hamilton, our first UND female law graduate. My name is Jennifer Cook. I'm a lawyer and a professor here at the University of North Dakota School of Law, and I teach in the Lawyering Skills Program, which is the legal writing and research course for first-year law students. And it's my first year as a faculty member, and so I come here to the university as the former policy director for the American Civil Liberties Union of North Dakota. And prior to that, I clerked for Magistrate Judge Karen Klein for the District of North Dakota in Fargo. And in fact, I never thought I would be a lawyer when I was a little girl either. I love animals and thought for sure I was going to be a marine biologist. And somehow I ended up in the field of law. But I think from an early age, I was born and raised in North Dakota. I have a very conservative family. But from an early age, and I'm not sure, I was reflecting upon my experiences and what pushed me to become the woman that I am today. And I have to say it was probably my mother, first of all, although I don't have very concrete memories of her telling me that I could be anything I wanted to be or that I shouldn't let certain things stop me. But there was never a lack of support for the things that I wanted to do. So I'm a small town girl from North Dakota who at a very young age knew that there was something different about being a woman in this world, meaning that I could see the injustices that even as a little girl that girls faced, even in education. And so eventually I ended up in the military, mostly to pay for school because I knew that I wanted a college education. I knew a college education would open doors for me. And so I thought the only way to do it was to join the military. And I come from a military family, and so I did that. And I spent 10 years in the military and rose in the ranks and commanded companies of soldiers, even on deployment, and worked for a United States senator during that time after college. My undergraduate degree is in mass communication, public relations. And so I realized when I worked for the Senate that you needed to have people who knew what they were doing make the laws, right? And I thought, not a lot of our representatives in either the state houses or the federal Congress have that experience. Why don't they go to law school? Why don't they know what it means when they write a law and the effect that it has on regular, ordinary people who are calling the U.S. Senate office every single day saying, please don't vote yes on this bill. And so I decided that at some point I was going to change things and go to law school and then maybe one day run for office. And that has yet to happen, but that's my story about how I eventually got to law school here and ended up clerking for Magistrate Judge Klein and then got to the ACLU and now finally here. So I'm really thrilled to be able to develop the next generation of lawyers. I see it as our responsibility to do so. So thank you for having me.
Good morning. My name is Missy Heilman. I am the founder and executive director of BioGirls. So I bring a totally different perspective to the panel this morning because I do not have a law background, but I am a strong advocate for women and girls throughout the Upper Midwest through our BioGirls program. BioGirls stands for Beautiful Inside and Out. I graduated from UND in 2001, went on to get my MBA from NDSU shortly after that, and I've worked in the marketing, high-tech marketing industry for 17 years. About 7 years ago, I started BioGirls as a way to give back to girls in our community. I've had a lot of female role models and mentors in my life, like my mother, who I was just talking to my friend Jess, who worked full-time the entire time I was growing up, and I always remember thinking how proud I was of her for having a career. And we lived in a little town. She was the postmaster, so she had this visible, high-ranking position in our community. I never thought, oh, I wish my mom was home, like most of my friends had their mom at home. But anyway, I looked for a way to give back to young girls about, I don't know, 8 years ago or so, and didn't really find a match. And so I created BioGirls, combining a couple of my passions. And since then, so in the 7 years that I've been doing BioGirls, it has now turned into my full-time job. We have 32 locations across the Upper Midwest, and this year we will have 1,200 girls go through our program. So I'll talk a little bit more about what BioGirls is as we go today.
Very much for sharing your backgrounds and how you came to be in the position that you are today. We'll transition into the questions that we've prepared for this panel. And we'll start with, what hurdle did you have to overcome specifically being a woman in your field of work? And Missy, maybe we'll go reverse order and we'll start with you.
Sure. So as I was preparing for today, I do this often. I have three girls. They're 13, 11, and 5. And I like to share about my career, my work, what I do on a day-to-day basis with them, because I think it helps them understand that I choose to work and I love what I do. And they feel ownership of what I'm doing. So last night as I was preparing, I was reading some of the questions to my 13-year-old. And when I read this question, I told her I was going to answer in this way. You know, I've overcome a lot of hurdles in my life because I was a 400-meter hurdler in college, which is a true story. but on a more serious note, you know, I don't know that I personally have experienced, you know, too many hurdles or obstacles personally. But when your career is your brainchild, when the organization you work for is the one you founded, it's hard to separate the personal from the organizational obstacles. And one of the things that we have been fighting with BioGirls is this perception that it's a nice program. Like, I always get the response, oh, that sounds so nice. That must be so fun. In reality, it's not a nice to have, it's a need to have. So research shows that almost 3/4 of adolescent girls struggle from low self-esteem. It's an epidemic. And we are working to change those statistics. That is our mission, and that is why we exist. And so that perception is something that we have worked extremely hard on overcoming in the last 7 years. And I would say in the last year, I think we're starting to see that perception change. And that has been through a lot of hard work. One of the things that we have done is expand our network of advocates. So we are partnering with professionals in the mental health industry who are referring girls into our program and seeing results. And, you know, they are our advocates out in the industry. The other way we've done that is by implementing a research study that proves the effectiveness of our program. So our program is a 12-week program where we combine life skills curriculum that we have written, produced, mentoring. So we're pairing adolescent girls with adult mentors, female role models in their community, and then we incorporate physical activity as well as a way to teach accountability, to offer the opportunity to set goals and accomplish those goals, and to teach them how to deal with adversity, because not every day is a good day. So we implemented a research study last year that prove the effectiveness of that program. And then finally, lifetime, we've had about 2,700 participants go through our program. And those participants and their parents become our best word of mouth advocates. We have seen from day one that the program is effective. And now when we have parents out there sharing the success that they've seen with their own kid through the program, it's really helping us change that perception.
I just want to start off by saying that I think my life has been pretty easy compared to many other people. I sit here as a white woman who has an education, who had a fairly low to middle class background. I don't think that any door has been slammed in my face because I am a woman. But I sit here with a certain amount of privilege, and I want to recognize that because I know others who haven't had the opportunities that I have had because of very discriminate reasons. So I want to preface my comments by saying that, first of all. I think, of course, I've had challenges as an individual. Maybe they've been because I am a female. Maybe they haven't been. Maybe they've just been challenges, period, like any other person faces. I think particularly my experience in the military was challenging as a female. It is still a very strong male-based organization. And so when I entered, it was 1996. I was 17 years old. I was a very slight-framed, young, fresh-faced woman. It was something that I didn't necessarily do because I felt that I had a calling to serve my country. It was something I did as a vehicle to get where I wanted to go and do it in an economical way, meaning pay for college. I'm the first child of my family to go to college, and my parents didn't have a lot of money, and so I needed to figure out a way to get to where I needed to go. And so I think the challenges I faced in the military are just par for the course for what any other woman faces in the military, meaning there's always the stigma that you have to be not just as good as the men in your field, but better than the men in your field, because otherwise you don't belong there. And so there was always that constant pressure to run faster and farther, to carry more, to be tougher. And frankly, the sexual innuendos and comments and often harassment you would face from your peers who were supposed to be your teammates and colleagues was an everyday occurrence, right? So I think that that's just something that every single one of us as a woman has probably faced at one time or another, whether you're in the military or you are a daycare provider or a stay-at-home mom. I mean, we see it when we walk down the street, the catcalls, the objectification, and having to do better, to do more, just to prove yourself that you belong there. And so I can't point to one particular moment where it was particularly challenging, but I do feel like I stood on the shoulders of giants, because clearly I wasn't the first woman ever in the North Dakota Army National Guard or the Colorado Army National Guard, but I was very cognizant of the women who had come before me, who had done it. And you could look around and see 95% male faces and 5% of us were females. And you knew that it was important to support each other. So I think that facing challenges as a woman is always, we face challenges differently. So we recognize that that stigma is there and we push on nevertheless. And, while I can't point to one particular person who said, no, you can't do this, the reason I pursued leadership in the military after I was went through basic training and all the initial training you go through is because I realized that to change the system, sometimes you have to be within the system and you have to take on a leadership role to show others, other women, that you can do it, and to show your counterparts, the male counterparts, that yes, a woman can lead. She does not have to be tough and when I mean tough, I mean abrasive. Your exterior does not need to be abrasive. You do not need to lead the same way a man leads. You can lead in a way that feels authentic to you, meaning that you can have empathy for others, that you can be soft-spoken but firm. And so I think that although I might have not faced the same challenges as many of the other ladies at the table, I certainly always felt the pressure to be better than my male counterparts. And so inherently that sets you up for a mental game you play with yourself. And it's a challenge that I think, you know, it's just in no fault of their own. In some sense, men just don't deal with every single day, depending on who you are. But I can say personally, at some point in my career, when I came to the ACLU, I was fresh off a clerkship in the court system, and I was very intent on continuing to do work that made me feel like I was making a difference in the world. And that's one of the reasons I became a lawyer. And so working on civil rights issues was certainly something that I felt I could wake up every single day and look at myself in the mirror and say, you are doing the work that needs to be done, whether it's one step at a time. And at some point you pour so much of yourself into your work and you work 60, 80 hours a week and you don't give yourself the self-care that I found myself in the middle of that career facing a mental health crisis for myself, which I never thought that I would ever experience. And so when I say mental health crisis, I mean panic attacks and anxiety symptoms, physical symptoms where I could name not sleeping at night, shaking, burning skin, headaches, numbness, joint pain, just loss of hearing on one side of my left ear. And I had no idea what was happening to me. And I went to neurologists, I went to the Mayo Clinic, and finally I found a neurologist that said, there's nothing, you don't have MS, you don't have anything that is going to kill you. You are dealing with anxiety symptoms, and it's telling you that you need to take care of yourself and slow down. And it's not, everything is not in your control. And so that was a challenge personally that I faced, having to overcome and get better physically and mentally, get better. And for somebody who always was in control and who thought they had their life together, having that physical and mental thing take you off the tracks was a wake-up call. And I think probably the thing I'm most proud of in the world besides my children is the fact that for the last 2 years, I have been on a road of recovery. And so I am intent on speaking out about mental health, especially in lawyering, because there's a stigma around talking about this type of thing. And I don't think that's fair. And I don't think it's healthy for any of us. And so I would say that has been my particular challenge, not necessarily as a woman, but a human being, is realizing that, sometimes you don't have it all together and you need to stop and you need to take care of yourself, and then you can take care of the others around you, including your career and the people that you have set out to help.
For sharing that, Professor Cook, I know a lot of what Lou spoke about last night was the importance of building up your support network and having the courage to step and have those difficult conversations.
And I'll take what Professor Cook just ended with, and I'll start from there. Many people have asked me questions about resilience and about how do you find the strength to come back. And it's one of the things that I've spoken to lawyers about since I was injured, because I had to figure that out for myself. I knew after I was injured that I was going to come back to practice, that wasn't that I was thinking, oh, I'm not going to let this stop me. It's just I naturally wanted to come back to work. This interruption, this intrusion in my life, in my space, I just saw it as that. But it got me to thinking, you know, where do you find resilience? Where do you find strength to be able to overcome adversity and challenges in your life? And much of it comes from a lot of hard work and acknowledging and having insight into the importance of self-care, about your mental and emotional wellness. Without the work that I had done in the years preceding, I found my practice very challenging, family law practice. I've had other circumstances in my life involving my partner and his career and difficulties that our family experienced as a point where I realized I wasn't healthy to keep doing my own work in my profession, in my practice, where I had people in emotionally traumatic circumstances coming to see me, asking me to help them get through what people call, you know, the most traumatic experience men or women, a breakdown in a marriage will ever experience. And so I immediately turned to see a therapist. I knew that I wasn't going to be okay. And I am so glad to hear Professor Cooks talk about it, because one of the things I need to convey to people, whoever will listen to me, is that it's so important, incumbent on us, the lawyers who are going to be modeling for other lawyers and young lawyers, that we're human, that we're vulnerable, and that we have our own challenges, whatever they may be in our lives, and that you can't do it alone. You can't expect to be bearing the burden of your family responsibilities, your own baggage, which we'll get into, but and also the real challenging problems that your clients come with, that come to you and they burden you with. So for me, it's important to talk about what I did in order to be, what I think helped me. What happened to me is quite catastrophic. My injuries were very serious, and the impact of being targeted as a woman lawyer for doing what my job is, to show up at my office and to represent someone, it's beyond rattling. It can be shifting. It can cause you to decide that, you know, this is not for me. So many lawyers said to me, you had an out. Why are you coming back to this kind of work? But the reason I think that I had the ability to come back to it was because I had the time to build and work on what I needed to withstand, know, the unexpected. I mean, there are a lot of things that will be expected. I mean, there are things that people have happen in your life. You know, the illness in a family, a death of a close person, children, issues with children, medical diagnoses. These are things that are predictable. So if you don't plan for how these things will interrupt and impact your life, you put yourself at risk. So for me, in my practice and in my life, there's a real distinct line for me about my life before I was injured and afterwards. And in many ways, have to say there have been significant positive changes in my life, despite the fact that I was, you know, wish I could go back in time and this never happened. But I see how much more grounded I am now, because I think about myself as a person who can be vulnerable and a person who can, who can't do it all by myself. There are so many supports that we can turn to. And, you know, me before I was injured, you know, I had a lot of insecurities about, you know, we are in a very competitive field, you know, everybody wants to be the best, and we criticize each other all the time. In fact, school is about criticism, right? You're graded on your performances. When you're a litigator, there's a winner and a loser. You're judged by everyone. You're judged by opposing counsel. You're judged by your clients. You're judged by the court. This strive for perfectionism can be really, really damaging to us. And now that I don't look perfect anymore, I don't feel perfect, it's actually given me some freedom to let go of some of those ideas of needing to be the best or be the perfect, and to have a practice where what you present is all that matters. It's allowed me to let go of many things. It's given me more freedom to be my authentic me. And as I said before, I think that it's powerful that we recognize that we are all people first. We are not perfect. We have, we make mistakes, and that what counts is that you are, you've got your own structural integrity about what it is that matters to you and what you want to accomplish. And that we should be kinder to each other, because all of you who get into law school are intelligent, bright people. Graduates of law schools are intelligent, bright people. And we just have this system where we're judging and we're competing for positions for clerking and articling. We talk about support in our legal community. We talk about supporting, and that's one thing I have to say, why this change shifted for me is that when I was injured, I saw an incredibly remarkable thing. The legal community in Winnipeg, across Canada, the way that we came together and supported each other, and I know Tracy is here from Winnipeg, and she remembers it was a very traumatic time in a time in our community that people were very, three bombs were sent that day. I wasn't the only lawyer targeted. The lawyer for the husband, he sent a bomb to his own lawyers. He also sent a bomb to his wife. The one that exploded in my office, I was the only one at work on a long weekend, and I was, because I intercepted it, the other two, what happened to me, the other two bombs were intercepted. My point is that the law firms, the legal community was very rattled about, you know, for the first time, I think in a long time, that something like this could happen in Winnipeg. And I saw an outpouring of kindness, support, a commonality, this, we're in it together. And that almost has the flip side in a profession where we as litigators can be really hard on each other, and we as colleagues can be hard on each other. So I think that if we keep reminding ourselves that we are first people, ordinary people, just wanting to eke out a living and do good and be good, we'll have a more wholesome, happier practice. And, you know, the last thing I'll say before, I don't want to take too much time, I know I'm rambling, but one of the things that was very real for me was how I started asking questions about things about, after I was injured, about, you know, whether I was targeted for being a woman in law. And that was, and that still is something I struggle with. But the conclusion I've come to is that, you know, what happened to me was very extraordinary, like statistically. I mean, it's not something that we have to be mindful. And the next question was about, you know, workplace safety. And it was upsetting to me that we have to start thinking about, you know, coming to a workplace. I mean, I'm not in the military. I didn't sign up for having to that be a job risk. But you know, that made me think about, you know, my future in law and whether this was something that was, you know, something that I could come to, you know, each day and feel that I was at risk. And I immediately, you know, just said, no, that's not it. This was just an extraordinary thing. And we have supports. Our work that we do is important, and it's something that it's needed. People who work in family justice, I think, are the bravest people in the world. It's often thankless work, and you deal with people in very, very difficult times. And the other thing that came out of what happened to me is my thoughts about, well, what can I do about what I experienced, and how can I share this with my colleagues in the profession, and what can I offer? And I think that it comes down to me less about what happened to me in that extraordinary experience, but to the work that goes behind the scenes of ensuring that you are able to withstand and you're capable and you've worked on it to withstand all the things that you can never predict in your practice and in your life. So facing adversity generally is something that I think that have to talk about, we have to be open about, and have dialogue at the earliest stages and even within our profession.
I know, I think we could be here all day if we could. So Ms. Mazuzis, you talked about that ongoing support that you received after the incident. And last night we heard from Lou about the importance of mentorship and building up that network around you to support you to achieve your goals and how that starts in law school. Really before that, you know, Missy, you're mentoring your children and being an advocate for them. And it continues to transition into your professional life of the importance of continuing that support and continuing that mentorship and learning to grow. And so how do we help future women and young women succeed? LWC, last year we implemented a mentorship program, which we've continued this year, and we've seen a lot of growth in that program and a lot of success in that program, not only with the members that are still at the law school, but even our alumni who graduated last spring who are continuing to mentor those mentees. So what is your stance on mentorship and how do we continue to build that support network for women? I guess start with Missy.
Okay. In terms of how to help future women succeed, I think the number one thing that we can do is to adjust our mindset to understand and believe that someone else's success does not impact your ability to succeed. Our society has turned into this everybody's your competition type society. Especially, I mean, it's any age. At any age, we're experiencing that. We see it with the kids that we work with. Their friend is also their competition. Are they getting an A? If they get an A, you know, will they all the A's be given out? And that's the mentality that little girls are growing up with. No longer do they feel like their friends have their back. They're watching their backs. So I think as role models, no matter what your profession is, being able to celebrate the success of your peers, being able to lift others up and to be their support system is so important. I'm going to go back to track for a moment and say, I think that was ingrained in my DNA being a track athlete. Our fiercest rivals, we were cheering for them because we understood the hard work, the dedication and the determination it took to compete at that high level. And the same holds true in the business world. People are working really, really hard. And, you know, both of you mentioned it. We need to celebrate that instead of trying to cut people off at the knees. Let's lift them up. In terms of mentorship, switching careers 17 years in, being brand new to the nonprofit world, I had to seek out mentors. There were a lot of things that translated from the for-profit world to the nonprofit world that set me up to be able to run an organization. But there were so many things I didn't know, and many things I didn't know I didn't know. So I sought out other nonprofit leaders. I live in Fargo, so I sought out other nonprofit leaders in Fargo. And again, they could have viewed me as competition because we're all funded by donors. So in a sense, yes, we are competing for donor dollars, but they did not. They welcomed me with open arms and shared their best practices. In fact, we were awarded a very large grant from the Otto Bremer Foundation. And I give a lot of credit to one of my friends and mentors who had been awarded a grant in the past. And she stood by me, you know, all the entire journey through that grant process, which is a good 6 months at minimum. And so I'm so grateful for those other nonprofit leaders who are willing to provide their expertise, share their best practices, encourage me. And, you know, you all are, I think the majority of you are going down the path of a career in law. But I would suggest searching for a mentor outside of your industry, because having multiple perspectives only helps you grow as an individual. And I've been so fortunate throughout my career to have some really solid mentors, both female and male, who have guided me along the way.
I'm going to take a bit of a macro level look at how do we mentor young women, or at least make the world an easier place to be a young girl or a young woman and for them to succeed. And I'm a mother of two boys, 8 and 5. And everyone always asks me, are you going to try for a third child so that you can have a girl, right? And I used to entertain the question. And then I started thinking about it and I thought, no, I'm really happy being the mother of boys, and I think it's a really important role to have. And here's why. When we talk about mentoring young girls, we need to include boys in the conversation about how women are their equals and are just as important. And so I feel my role as a mother to two young boys who will be young men someday, and I think it's vitally important that they're at the table when we talk about women's issues as human rights issues, because if I don't raise boys to respect young girls and young women, then I've failed as a human being, and I've failed our society and our community. And so I really struggle with the, well, you have to have a girl, a young girl to mentor. And I know, no, you do not. So I challenge each of you out here to reach out to young boys or young men in your life and include them in the conversation about how we make the world a better place for young girls and women. And ultimately, it makes it a better place for young boys and men, because we've heard a lot about toxic masculinity, and I think it's just entirely unfair for our society to pigeonhole boys and girls in these places they're supposed to be with regard to gender roles. And so, first of all, I think that, yes, we need to mentor young girls and women, but we need to take the boys by the hand and say, here's how you do it. Okay. The other thing, you know, I appreciate what you said about seeking out mentorship. And this goes to the question that you might ask later if we have time, is what would you tell your younger self? And I would tell, one of the things I would tell my younger self would be seek out mentors. Maybe it's part of my personality. I don't know, but I honestly didn't do that very much as a young person. And whether it's in high school or undergrad or even law school, now that I think about it. And so when I was thinking about, did I have a mentor? Well, sure, I had examples of strong women everywhere, but did I have a particular mentor that I went to and had the opportunity to ask all these questions and get insightful advice? Not necessarily all the time. And I always thought, oh, I wish I had one. And now that you said, seek them out, be proactive, I think I would tell my younger self, and I would tell all the young women in here, that it's incumbent upon you as well to seek out those role models and examples of women or men that you want to model yourself after. But I do have two recent examples of role models besides my mother. Is when I graduated from law school, I was 8 and a half months pregnant with my first child. And I knew that for myself, I wanted to stay home with my first child for at least the first year. It was important to me. It was important to my spouse. And so that's what I did. And unfortunately, that's not necessarily the path that maybe a mentor would say you should take as a young lawyer. You know, you should be out there getting that job, competing with the rest of them. And so I feel like I did have a bit of a setback, but here's where my mentor comes in. Magistrate Judge Klein gave me my first job out of law school. And I'm getting a little emotional about it because I will forever be grateful to her, because I had taken a year and a half off. And as a strong woman leader that she is, She said, you have what it takes to be my law clerk. You have the brains, you've done the work, and I want to give you an opportunity. And sometimes that's all it takes, is for one woman to lift up another woman. And that is absolutely what she did, and never had any question about my ability, and mentored me from day one and still does to this day. And so I would say I learned from her how to do that. So absolutely, when you say cut each other off at the knees, it is a competitive world, and law school certainly breeds that. But I learned from the very best that sometimes taking that alternative route is okay if you're authentically true to yourself, because there will be somebody out there that will give you the opportunity if you seek it. And then the other mentor is my colleague, Professor Mavrova Heinrich. She and I went to law school together, and she came to the academic world prior to my coming here, and she certainly knew that I wanted to teach and develop the future generation of young lawyers. And so it's a lateral mentoring too. So she knew I wanted to do it, and she was so incredibly generous with her talent and her time and her experience and helping me to get here, certainly. And then once I got here, to share her expertise and to not be, because knowledge really is power in so many senses. And so when she so generously shared everything she had experienced and everything she had done here for students with me and her other colleagues, you know, that is the best that you can ask for, really, is, again, not cutting you off at the knees, but saying, here, I know how hard it was for me when I started. Let me help pave the way for you so that you can do everything you have the talent to do and help mentor the young leaders and lawyers of the future. And so I'm just incredibly thankful for those two people and all the other people I can't name, but I think it's incredibly important to, one, take our boys and men by the hand, and then also lift up other women.
Do you mind if I piggyback on something you said? And it's something I myself have experienced, and I know the majority of women in here probably have or will experience, and that is being a working mother, and the challenges that come with that. So back in 2008, my husband worked, he was an orthopedic trauma sales rep, so he was on call 24/7. He wasn't around a lot. When he was around, if I wanted to do something outside of the home without my children, I had to have a nanny on call to be able to come if he got called away. So working full-time for me was extremely difficult. Now, my personality is not to be a stay-at-home mom, and that works for some people, and that's fine, but I knew that wasn't going to work for me. So I approached my employer at the time, a high-tech firm based out of Atlanta, and asked if I could cut back, because that's what I needed to do at that point in my life. And they were willing to let me cut back to 3/4 time, but they quote-unquote punished me, that's my words, not theirs, by taking away all the benefits that I had. Now, I wasn't expecting full benefits because I wasn't working full time, but the one thing that I wanted was the stock options. And again, not at the level that a full time employee was able to acquire them. But the company's response to that was that, that benefit is reserved for employees that are 100% dedicated to our company. And I was so angry. Because if you asked my manager or my colleagues about my productivity compared to a full-time employee, I was probably more productive. And I was 100% dedicated to the company for the 3/4 time that I was there. And recently I had a conversation with a friend of mine too. By the way, I left that company shortly after. And then I went on to do some consulting for 7 years. But I was having a conversation recently with a friend of mine who's a high-level executive at Sanford in Fargo. And she said that they are seeing female physicians, highly trained, highly skilled female physicians leaving the workforce at higher rates than they've ever seen. And I know if you have children and you're a working mom, you know why. You understand that there is no such thing as balance and something's got to give. But I believe as female leaders, we need to start creating opportunities for women at for different stages of their life. So one of the things that I'm really proud of at BioGirls is this inclusive environment that we are creating that is attracting women who are in that stage of life where raising their children is really important, but yet they don't want to give up their career. So we have two full-time and two part-time employees. Yes, we're a nonprofit. We do that not because we can't afford four full-time employees, but because those two full or those two part-time employees choose to work part-time. One's 20 hours a week, one's 30 hours a week. They're hardworking, they're dedicated, they're 100% committed to our organization and our mission. And we believe that we can continue to build our organization with that same type of model, whether it's a woman or a man who, you know, at a certain stage of life decides that they cannot work 40 hours and maintain sanity. And it's not going to be a detriment to our organization. And so I, again, no matter the industry, I would love to see more organizations working, working with their employees to create this type of inclusive environment.
Yeah, we'll open it up to some questions.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to pick up too on what Missy said. It's incumbent on women in leadership to affect and make the changes in their firms. I have to say our little firm of six lawyers now, by soon to be partner, we're buying this law firm and she's on a mat leave, you know? and I, you know, I'm thrilled for that. I'm thrilled that, you know, it's an option that may not have been an option in another context, in another firm, that she and I could plan to do what needs to be done, knowing that she's not going to be back in the office until September. We have two women, lawyers. We're all, it's a female, female-led firm and all women lawyers at my firm, two who are working part-time. They have small children and they are working 3 days a week. And, you know, it's funny. It's not about even just accommodating. Like even that word, accommodating people's choices, it's not, this is a reality. This is what we, it's like I say before, it's not unforeseeable that women lawyers are going to need to be flexible, to have children. And it's important for us to be shaping the kind of business model and the structure to deal with the obvious. We also have two junior lawyers. One of them has gone on a mat leave on January 1st and we're thrilled. I mean, the fact is we have a team of people who are committed and 100% dedicated. Even when there's 0% time in the office, I know that Heather is dedicated and to the future of our firm. And by giving the time and the space and the encouragement for her to have a life that fits all the goals she wants to accomplish as a, will make her a happier woman lawyer and will be back to my firm and will be there and look to the future and building for us. So to me, it makes absolute sense. And I'm so excited about stepping in this time. Mentorship, practical things. So we talk about some macro, but micro things. Show up for other women, you know, send a note, talk about the accomplishments, talk about the person you just heard about or something, a presentation you just saw from another woman in law. You know, men are so good at promoting my buddy who does this, my buddy who does that. I think Missy, it was such a great quote about, the success of one person doesn't have to be at
detriment to your own.
Yeah, success. Right. We don't have to compete. We have to talk about what other women in our profession are doing without feeling self-conscious. Like, oh my gosh, where did she find the time? How come I can't do that? You know, and one of the things that we were talking about at our dinner table yesterday with Tracy had brought up this great concept of being champions. You know, we have mentors and champions, and the champion is the person who
you know, the mentor is the role model, the person that you want to emulate, the one person you want to learn from, but the champion is the person who'll make that phone call and say, you know what? I have a great student who is tremendous, and this is what she's accomplished. Putting the bug in at networking activities, talking about the accomplishments of other women in your office, people that you know, those are the things you can practically, easily do. And sometimes it just doesn't come intuitively because we're worried about, I will look less accomplished, you know, letting go of that, because women have had to make up so much ground, right? And best thing we can do for all of us is to encourage all of our accomplishments, because it does lift everyone up. So,
yeah. And I think that's a great note to end on. A lot of what we've been talking about recently, I know in my conversations with some of second year law students, is this experience is what you make of it. And so showing up and supporting each other, I don't know where that's going to take you and what. I thank you for encouraging everybody to seek out mentorship and up and support each other. I will open it up to questions just for a couple minutes. I know Steph has a microphone that she can run around.
That's a great question, Sam. I think, so it's a lot about, so in the macro level, yes, we see a lot of divisiveness, right? And so that's why when I talk about women's rights, I like to say they're human rights, right? Because then it's not just about women. And I see faces of men in here today, which is absolutely what should be happening. They should be in the conversation. I think where it starts is this is my ACLU personality, my advocate, my grassroots. It comes from talking to the people you know. So the kitchen table talk, the politicians will say, where you sit down with those people that are closest to you. And so unintentionally, some of the men in my life have that unconscious, implicit bias, and they have no idea that they're putting that out there in the world, right? And they're very well-intentioned. And so coming at it from a place of just conversation and dialogue instead of just having the conversation. So it's not about changing a mind necessarily right away. It's just about having the dialogue. And so even if you get nowhere in that first conversation, and remember I said I come from a very conservative family, and our views sometimes differ, but finding that space where it's safe to have the difficult conversation about how you feel and then how they feel, and then having that no judgment at first, because I think a lot of what makes it divisive is there's this judgment of I'm right and you're wrong, correct? And so if we come from, and it's hard to do, it's hard to get out of that because we feel we're right, right? Whoever you are, man, woman, we feel we're right. We have the knowledge. We have the research. We've done our work. We know our position, right? And so we come in, I don't like that phrase, but we come in blazing, right? I won't use the weapon. I think leaving that behind, letting that go, and just having the conversation to begin with, whether it goes really well and you are able to have some type of dialogue that moves you further along the spectrum, or not, I think it's important to, one, acknowledge that the conversation needs to happen, two, have the conversation, and three, keep those lines of communication open, starting at the very grassroots level, who you know, and then involving them in the movement, right? So the Pink Hat movement, whatever you want to say, eventually grabbing them by the hand once you've had those conversations and it feels like a no judgment area, you will find you bring more people to that table. So just bringing people to the table to start with and then leaving the judgment behind and not expecting that you're going to convince somebody right away that your position is correct. I think that's the start. And there's a lot of other things you can do, but I think you have to start.
I think not using social media as your platform is also a good piece of advice. I have found in what I do, that it's really easy for people to sit behind a computer and whether it's put a post on Facebook or type an email, that's really easy to do and really easy for people to blah, it all out there. And our program is run 100% by volunteers. So our 32 locations are 100% volunteer led. And we deal with a lot of parents. So it's not necessarily women's rights kind of stuff, but we deal with parents. And I have found that they are very willing to criticize over an electronic communication. And we respond to all criticism or all complaints. And the way that we do that is we'd be happy to talk about this. Please give me a call. I don't provide my email address. And the number of people that actually make a phone call is very few and far between. So that's my advice.
Thank you so much, Ms. Hailman, Professor Cook, and Ms. Matusis for joining us. We'll give them a round of applause.